Welcome to T-Smack, home of the T-Smack. May I take your order?
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Talking Smack, where we talk superheroes, movies, animation, comics, and much, much more. I'm your host, Josh Scar, and joining me, as always, is your favorite Furalorian, hairless Star Wars creature. He puts the star in Star Wars. Alex, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. You've been avoiding all the Sith that are coming out since it's Revenge of the Sith today.
Revenge of the Force Sith. Man. How did you spend the highest of high holy days with May the 4th?
I watched the original trilogy. We had a bunch of stuff happening. Ended up swinging by a friend's house to deliver her a cake. She asked us to hang out. And
it's never good when your friend says, "Hey, I need a cake. Bring me one."
Well, it was a spontaneous thing. You know, she was like, "Hey, my
yeah." Again, if they say, "Bring me a cake," I'm concerned.
Hey, my wonderful wife, she went full out on it. 4-tier marbled fondant cake, and we delivered that thing.
Dang.
And you know what we got out of it? Watching Star Wars. And some ribs. I will say, watching, because it's been a few years since I watched the original trilogy, and I've never streamed it on Disney Plus. That movie is kind of sweaty. Like, some of those characters are glistening way more than they should.
Well, I mean, they're filming in a desert.
Yeah, but even like on the battleships and stuff like that there. And I'm like, okay, but the weirdest part is I never remember seeing this before. But during the trench run, there's a few shot angles where they shift the camera instead of like being face on with Vader to it's kind of a down an up angle because they show him like fiddling with the controllers.
Oh yeah, they got to make sure they get that in,
and you can see that the lenses aren't black, they're slightly red and opaque, and you can see the actor's eyes behind them, and I'm like, what? So I had to go back and pause it. I'm like, has anyone else noticed this?
I'm sure they have.
And now we're just, yeah, but now we're just, well, I met in the room. And now we're just staring going, this is wrong. Like, and so we hit play, I kept going. And then there was one more other angle, which was kind of like down into the side where it's up. And it's like, there's Vader's eyes. But none of the rest of the trilogy, they make sure that that's matte black. You can't see shit behind
it. I'm sure Lucas after that was very much like, I have an idea for what I'm going to do here, because the original concept had Vader being partners with Luke and I think it was Luke Starkiller and Anakin Skywalker or something like that, or Anakin Starkiller and Luke's, I think it was Anakin Skywalker and Luke Starkiller, and they were going to be partners that Anakin eventually betrayed and became Darth Vader. If I remember the original script concept properly. Hi, Kitty Cat.
Oh, hi.
talking to your other one. How does a cat have a pet cat? Isn't that like Mr. Potato Head advocating for this? We're going to be doing 90s nostalgia, so like this fits perfectly. Isn't this like Mr. Potato Head working for Burger King advertising the new French fries?
It's like someone owning Goofy. That, oh, crap. Who owns Goofy? It's
Disney?
Like a dog who owns. No. Ah, crap. I've heard this before. It's like, how does a dog own another dog in the Disney universe?
Oh, like how is Mickey best friends with Goofy, but also owns Pluto?
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. This doesn't quite make sense. She's loud right now. Hello, kitten. Like it's 4 inches from my microphone and purring.
We're going to hear from Tim, Joey, and Slade over at the Game Club Pod. And when we come back, we're going to bait you with some nostalgia. We'll be right back.
Join me, Joey, and my co-hosts,
Tim
and Slade,
at the Game Club Podcast, where every 2 weeks we review video games not too dissimilar from a book club. Looking forward to seeing you there, idiots.
Yeah, you stupids.
Tim, do you want to jump in on this?
I will not bandwagon audience abuse.
And just to remind everyone that when you subscribe to the Game Club Pod, you're not just subscribing to the Game Club Pod. You're subscribing to Two Blokes from Blighty, the monthly anime club that Slate has, as well as you are subscribing to Between Two Pods, which I believe is currently on a small hiatus as Slate took the month of April off. And I know they've done seasons for Between Two Pods, but I don't know how long of a break they took. So maybe it's a summer break for Slate for that. But when you subscribe to Game Club Pod, you get all that and more. So just a little extra boost there for our friends over at the Game Club Pod.
Exactly. Now, you get all that. And the cherry on top is the audience abuse. It's right there.
It's true.
You stupids.
I was also really proud of myself in their Discord. I should have said something maybe more publicly on Twitter, but on their Discord, I realized that when they were advertising their third year anniversary of joining Twitter, they have their own little inside joke meme on the podcast where Slade had rated a game a 3, and I believe it was Tim, from like the deepest part of his heart, as well as maybe his bowels, he just went 3. And it took off from there, because it was just one of those moments where it was just such a genuine reaction to this astonishing score that the number three and the enunciation of it in such a shocked manner is a meme. So when they were celebrating their third year anniversary of joining Twitter on their Discord, at least when they shared that, I just wrote 3 exclamation point question mark. And I know. Hi, Kat. Joey got it at least. So that was good stuff. And congrats on 3 years. And thank you guys for 3 years of wonderful podcasting. We're going to try and maintain at least our bare minimum standard of bare minimum. And we're going to get everyone with some nostalgia bait. We kind of already started talking about it, which, I mean, why not? We're in Star Wars weekend. Let's go here. Basically, we're just going to be talking about stuff from the 90s that either debuted or it had new things come out in the 90s. And I'm going to start with the 97 re-releases of the original Star Wars trilogy. Like, it's not technically new. It just is a refinish, but that's some of my earliest nerd stuff that I was like, yeah, I like this. This is, this is going to become part of my personality. I've shared this story before, but I remember seeing some of the Star Wars trilogy on WGN, which was a nationally broadcast station, but in the Illinois, Northern Illinois region, we got a local channel of WGN, not just like the national broadcast version. So like, we got a lot of different local stuff. And one of them was they regularly aired the original Star Wars trilogy. And because I'm not even a 13 year old. I'm preteen at 1997. I just would walk away. I'd be like, I want to play video games. I want to do this. I want to do that. So whenever I came back and it was now people in space fighting a giant golf ball, I was like, oh, this is something new. Instead of it being the people in the desert doing something there that looks kind of like Planet of the Apes. So when I finally sat down and watched these in the theater with my dad, I was like, oh my God, these are all the same movie. And it all clicked for me. I'm like, oh, this makes sense. Okay. I get it. And it took me probably another five years, but probably another 3 to 5 years to find out that like all this stuff was different about the trilogy. It wasn't just like they cleaned the film and they put it out. Cause I remember walking through a Shopko with my dad and after we had seen A New Hope in theaters, and we found VHS trilogies of the original prints.
Nice.
So my dad bought them for me. Like, I didn't even have to ask. My dad was like, you seem to like this. Let's get you this. And I don't even think he knew about the changes that were done to the 20th, which that's insane too. Like, 1997 was 10 years ago. And we were celebrating the 20th anniversary of Star Wars at that point, and now we're celebrating 40 somehow. Like, I don't know how that math works out with the 90s only being like 10 years ago. This is turning into me doing an old man rant, but like, I just, I have a soft spot in my heart for the re-releases. I do think the change to Han shooting second or tying with Greedo that was a mistake from George Lucas as well. I don't hate the music sequence as much as other people. But again, maybe that's because my initial introduction to the full breadth of what Return of the Jedi is included that. So maybe I'm just a little immune to it. But I don't think the 1997 re-releases, other than Han Solo not shooting first, changes too much that it's like, oh my God, I can't enjoy this. And I don't think a lot of the stuff they've done with the DVD releases has done that either. The only thing from any of the new releases, I believe, is when they released them on Blu-ray for the first time. The biggest change and the dumbest change that affects my viewing experience is in Return of the Jedi, when Vader's face turn happens, he is doing his back and forth with Luke and the Emperor. And then in the original print, he just goes and attacks the Emperor. In the Blu-ray release, the digital version, they've added in Vader going, no, no, no. And as he's doing the final no, he chucks the Emperor overboard. And that part removes a lot of the tension in that moment, because Vader is visually conflicted. We don't need the sound of it. And I think that's a big problem with George Lucas kind of doubling down, tripling down on Star Wars is for kids, which, fair play, it sure is. But kids can understand things. You don't need to spell everything out.
Yeah, I didn't come into Star Wars until I was maybe like 11, 12, somewhere in there. One of my cousins had the VHSs, and we watched one. He's like, oh, yeah, I really like this movie. And I was like, oh, cool. And I enjoyed it. And then, I don't know, a few days later, we watched the second one. I was like, that was like so, oh my gosh, it was great. He's like, and then at the end of that one, he went, oh, he's like, yeah. And the next one, he and Vader have another fight. I was like, there's a third one. And we went into it. And I remember that push, like you were talking about, that huge push on Disney Plus, talking to, not Disney, on ABC, talking about, oh yeah, we're re-releasing them. There's touch-ups. There was a special about them, mm-hmm. but all the little things you can do now and all these things. But oh, this is the, you know, the first one was just so, you know, it's like I was so bare string budget. There's things I needed to do, and look at this beauty that we can pull off. Mos Eisley's now huge. And so I
fleshing out Mos, fleshing out Bespin, Cloud City. That is something that, like, I don't know how anyone in the 80s. Saw Cloud City and then went and saw the re-releases in 97 and was like, why the fuck did they do that? Like,
that was huge.
I mean, I think Empire is probably the one that benefits the most from the 97 re-release. I don't know that they changed too much from that, except adding in additional background flavor.
Yeah, there's a lot of polish, just little effects here and there, some of the matte lines and other stuff. They really just kind of smooth out. But really, it seems like the only thing they need to do was those just beauty shots, those hero shots of Mos Eisley. And especially, it's, yes, they added a ton to the landing sequence. And when
the added Han Jabba scene, too, like that, it's the one where Han is getting the Falcon ready. And when he shows up, Boba Fett and Jabba are there. Like that scene, like, I think. For 1997, it's kind of a technical marvel where they went, we'll just shift the frame and make Han walk over Jabba's tail. And like, cool, you did it. Did this scene actually need to happen?
No. And of course, the glamour shot of Boba Fett just walking, looking at the camera and walking off. But Cloud City in particular, the making all of those little gray indentions be portholes to see outside of the city is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It really changes Lando from being just a guy who apparently runs a little place called Cloud City to, oh, holy crap, he's in charge of a city in the clouds.
Yeah.
And that is just lovely. Return of the Jedi, I didn't notice as much.
I don't know how much extra polish they added to that. I think they spent most of their budget on the musical sequence. Because, I mean,
right.
There's three human backup dancers, backup singers, and then there's two fully CGI characters.
Yeah, which is, that's rough nowadays. A lot of those polished sequences looked great in 97, do not age well. And you see, and I, what I find funny is you really can see, especially with the who knows what version remastered they are on Disney Plus, but you can really see kind of like some of the cheapness of the outfits. It's even in Return of the Jedi, like Luke walks in for that first sequence where he's going into Jabba's palace, and you can see just how thin of a piece of cloth that cloak is, because it's just porous light just pouring through him. And
well, again,
I'm
sure they're not going to put him in a full wool cloak in the middle of the desert.
He is a Jedi. He can withstand it. He ran with a, you know, probably like a 20-pound clay foam puppet on his back, and Frank Oz.
That was on a soundstage, though. Like, that was an air-conditioned soundstage.
Did you see those backflips?
Run.
That was tough.
I can be your backpack while you run. Swing from a hairy vine. I can be your backpack while you climb.
Well, no, I'm sorry. Adding Hayden Christensen to the end. See,
yeah. That was the... Was that the Blu-ray release, or was that the... that wouldn't have been the 04 re-release with the DVDs. The original DVD releases, would it?
I think
that was the Blu-ray.
Yeah. What I find funny about that now is because they got rid of the original actor and replaced his Force Ghost with, you know, 27-year-old Hayden Christensen, now we have like the Acolyte or whatever the heck, the Osaka show.
Oh wow, it was the 2004 DVD edition.
They released it with a DVD edition?
Apparently, oh. Yeah. Sebastian Shaw was replaced with Hayden Christensen at the end of the 2004 DVD edition, Return of the Jedi. Even George Lucas, 20 years later.
Well, I'm wondering if, because of, you know, Osaka and the not great de-aging they did on him, he does look like a man who's in his 40s now.
I don't even know if they did de-aging on him. Like, did they just do like a little makeup and some touch-ups? Because like, I feel like they didn't do a lot with it, which is part of what made it a little extra uncanny valley.
I feel like they did, but I really want them to go and now move the Force Ghost with the current, you know, just do one more, just one more edit. Come on.
Yeah.
Just
I mean, George, he would be age appropriate for when, when he should be at this point. It's 20 years later.
Exactly. Just slide him in there.
Yeah. Just do a quick scan, have him do his awkward little, like Ted Mosby, hands in the pockets, shy looking up.
Exactly.
Conveying a shy sense of vulnerability.
And you know what? Just slide Ewan in there. He's getting close to the
Alec Guinness didn't care about being in those movies. Like, let's just add Obi-Wan in there. Why not? I mean, it's implied that Leia can see them too. So, like, she never saw old man Kenobi. She saw hot middle-aged Kenobi.
Yeah, just release the smack cut. That's what we want.
Topher Grace, you have your next assignment.
Hell yeah.
So part of what instigated this whole thing was last week we were talking about Disney owning the Muppets and that just being a whole merchandising thing more than anything. But after we recorded and we went to bed, I just kept thinking about Jim Henson stuff and what I would rather go back to than anything pre or post Jason Segel Muppets, because that failed office style TV show and anything else they've done is just not great. But it just led me down that rabbit hole that most any nerd would understand, where you just like you pivot from like one conversation in your head to another. And it led me to the point where I was like, Dinosaurs, that was an amazing show, and that was created by Jim Henson Productions. And I just was like, it's a cult show because I feel like so many people right now really only remember it for like Baby Sinclair, Not the Mama, I'm the Baby Gotta Love Me, the rap video that they made based off of those catchphrases. But they forget that Dinosaurs was a Simpsons level sitcom that hit some really good points, and it maybe comparing it to The Simpsons is not quite what it should be. Maybe it's more like Futurama, where it does a similar concept where it's like modern day premise with a different perspective, whereas Futurama, it's the future, and with dinosaurs, it's the framing device is this is the first time anyone's ever done something like this, because I believe it's like with the invention of the refrigerator, they have been able to domesticate themselves, which with domestication, they're able to get married and have families. And there's like an entire episode where Fran's getting cranky because the baby won't let her sleep. And so Earl decides he has to relearn the mating dance and like re-woo Fran because no one has ever had marital issues before. And so he's trying to figure all this out with his buddy, Roy, the T-Rex. And the conversations they have in that episode are just fantastic. Cause it's like, yeah, you see how this applies today, but they're framing it in a way that makes it hilarious because again, that's the first time there has ever been marital problems. So within the context of the show, and to kind of add emphasis to what I'm trying to say, this is a line from the show when they were trying to really drive home the point of like, yeah, we're animatronics, we're puppeteers, but you're kind of missing the point of the show.
Hey, Freddy, you gotta see this puppet show. It's terrific.
Uh-huh. Earl, that's for kids.
Yeah, you'd think that because they're puppets. So the show seems to have a children's aesthetic. Yet the dialogue is unquestionably sharp-edged, witty, and thematically skewed to adults.
And when he says that last line, he is looking directly into the camera. He is breaking the fourth wall, literally. And there's one other scene that I really want to point out here just because, again, it perfectly encapsulates what I just shared here. So this is, I believe it's called a show called Triceracops within the series. And this is from an episode where Earl gets hired to be a TV executive because he knows how to frame the primetime slots. And he does such an amazing job that people are getting dumber because they are so glued to their televisions. And in the scene leading up to this clip from Triceracops, Robbie passes out, and that's the son. And Fran, the mom, has to pick him up. And he's like, oh, sorry, mom, I just forgot to breathe again. Because he's been so invested in television that his mental capacities are just failing. So this is what Earl has done to try and smarten up TV.
Please, hold it right there.
Come on.
Don't shoot. I surrender.
We're not gonna shoot you.
They want to re-educate you.
You see, son, you're just the product of an alienated economic class, lashing out because you feel powerless and unloved.
You've been disenfranchised by the bourgeois power structure.
That's right.
I stole a car. I'm a thief.
Well, son, if you think about it, all property is theft.
Oh.
Let me explain how the surplus value of the worker is being exploited in the marketplace. You see, when the means of production...
We made a few changes in the shows.
It's funny because it's true.
Oh my... I immediately thought of Teen Titans Go because...
Don't you dare compare dinosaurs to Teen Titans Go.
Because Teen Titans Go, yes, they are the jerk titans, but he teaches an episode... there's an episode where Robin teaches him about like... the lending economy and ride sharing and, you know, not owning property. And then another one about it, he teaches about investment properties and income taxes. And out of nowhere, you're watching. It's like, of course, the rest of the Titans don't give a crap and are just ragging on it and immediately break whatever it is he's trying to teach them. But
Mr. Feeny is dead.
Whoops.
Oh, no.
Start over.
And so.
Oops. No.
Well,
stop.
It's probably no.
And so you're getting this actual moral lesson about how the world works within the parameters of this kid's show. And I'm listening to Dinosaurs, and I know I haven't thought about that show in a while, and I should go rewatch it. But I remember I remember being vividly impressed as a kid when Robbie gets sent off to war, and they're working on like a tagline of why the two legs and the four legs need to be fighting each other. And I'm sure this is probably around the Gulf War when they wrote the show. from watching this, I'm like, oh, you know, he's at war. Cool. The war is great. You know, this is going to be awesome. And then they break it down as, we have come up with a phrase for what it is we're doing to destroy the four legs. We are right. We will call this war. And as a kid, I was like, is that what war really means? Is this why we're fighting each other? Because we believe we are right. And then they're showing, of course, both sides of it. And it, I think it was maybe 2-3 episode arc.
It was a 2-part episode. Yeah.
It was a 2-part. And I remember finding nuance in the world, and that really hurt as a child.
Yeah, there's so many things in the show that, again, I know people bring it up from time to time, but it does feel like it has become kind of an underappreciated classic, within the cult classic community, because people remember, again, Baby Sinclair. They remember little things. They remember certain episodes. Like, there's one episode where Fran and Earl are getting ready to celebrate their anniversary, and Earl has procured like the last two of this like most delicious species of mammal that is still around, but they're the final two, and Robbie's keeping them a secret or hiding them in his room while Earl is getting ready to prepare them for his anniversary dinner. And because they're mammals, they're smart and they can talk. And Robbie's like, oh man, my food can talk, crazy. And he learns about them and he becomes attached to them. And throughout the course of the episode, eventually Earl's boss, Mr. Richfield, I believe is his name, the big triceratops that can't leave his trailer, he finds out that Earl has these mammals, and he basically threatens Earl's job that if he doesn't bring them to Mr. Richfield, he's gonna fire him. And so Earl's kind of left with no choice. He needs income to take care of his family, so he's going to bring them to him. And there's this whole like poignant thing, because Earl has learned to appreciate them as well. And Robbie and Earl are sad, and they have this wonderful moment. And then the episode ends where we see that these mammals have had babies. Because I think, if I'm remembering correctly, part of the episode is also that it's a male and a female, and they don't get along. They're just like, oh, he's... Look at him. Like, why would I date him? And he's like, well, you're no ray of sunshine either, lady. And it's just a beautiful episode. And it's kind of like Jurassic Bark in Futurama, where it's not necessarily going to make you cry, but it's going to make you feel things that you're like, these are puppets. These are dinosaur puppets that are making me feel and get on the verge of having tears. And it, like, yes, there's occasional moments where it's silly and funny, but there are a lot of really amazing episodes. Like, there's an episode where Robbie, he's going to try vegetarianism, and it's framed like it's an anti-drug episode. And as the episode progresses, it becomes more of like an LGBTQ story, where Robbie is kind of discovered a part of himself that he hadn't really acknowledged before, because his family were meat eaters. So he must be a meat eater. And it's a really beautiful episode with a great message of acceptance and tolerance and parental change, even, because I believe Earl is like, okay, yeah, we can have vegetables at the table by the end of the day. And it frames it so wonderfully that it's hard to just say like, oh yeah, it's a funny animatronic sitcom but with dinosaurs. It does so much more. And even as a kid, like, I didn't understand it at the time, but I bought the box sets when they came out, and when they came on Disney Plus, I binged it again. And yeah, it gets remembered mostly for the final episode, because it's like, oh, this colorful, funny show about dinosaurs in a sitcom setting that's kind of like Married with Children ended on such a depressing note about global warming. And 30, almost 30 years ago, 25 years ago, this show that ending would have made headlines today, because it was very poignant. It was very prescient, and it hit home with a very important message that just kind of got lost in the TGIF shuffle back in the day. Cause I think that was around the time Full House was ending, and there are a handful of other shows that were kind of hitting a peak So dinosaurs just kind of got left behind, especially considering the budget that it was on. Cause I think it was like either the last or the second to last show of the night by that time with TGIF. And it just never gained traction after the first season. But I think they had a contract for so many seasons, but it was such an amazing show that it does exactly what that first sound clip. It's puppets. So kids are drawn into it, but there is something beneath it. Same thing with Futurama, same thing with The Simpsons, and to a smaller extent, Family Guy, and a lot of other animated shows, which proves like the point of animation and puppetry as art storytelling formats. Just because they look like they're for kids does not mean they are. It doesn't mean they are only for kids, I should say. Because to kind of drive this last point home, when The Incredibles 2 came out, someone had commented about how there's a portrait in Helen's hotel room where there's like one image of a line, and then there's like four red lines that are like separated by a barrier. And it's a very obvious imagery of like Helen being separated from her family within the movie. And someone did a screen capture of it, posted on the internet. And Brad Bird, the director, was like, "Hey, yeah, this is great catch." And the person responded with like, "Oh man, so many great things in this kids movie that so many kids will never understand." And Brad Bird responded to that going, "Well, it's not a kids movie. It's an all ages movie. There's something for everyone to enjoy in this. It's not just something made to give adults have their kids be distracted for a few hours. We want adults to get something out of this too." And that's what I think Dinosaurs is. And most animated features can be that as well. Minions is not. Let's just put it plain and simple. There are some things that are definitely just geared towards kids. But animation was originally intended to be an alternative storytelling device to be able to tell bigger stories that could not be filmed and could not translate into live action. Like we've talked about this as well before, where John Carter was planned to be the first animated feature movie ever made, John Carter of Mars. There, I believe it was Warner Brothers was working on making that into the first feature length animated feature. But because John Carter is apparently cursed to never be adapted well into any kind of storytelling format other than novels, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs beat them to the punch, and then it went into over 100-year production hell. But animation can be, and puppeteering can be, so much more. We talked about it last week with Muppet Treasure Island, with A Muppet Christmas Carol, and so many other things that the Muppets have done, and Sesame Street. Like, yeah, they're puppets and kids are drawn to them because they're silly and wacky and they look interesting. But if you go deeper and look into what they're saying, you're going to get a whole different world out of it. And that's Dinosaurs to a T.
Very well said. I haven't revisited them since it ended and just being devastated. It holds this kernel. It holds this kernel in my head of, you know, being 9 years old, and I'm like, I just can't go back to that. But I've seen mentions in blogs and articles and stuff like that about the show and how it was just so severely misunderstood. It was a huge hit its first season. They tried to move it to anchor other stuff around it, and they just killed it in the shuffle. When you mentioned that you wanted to talk about it, I looked up some clips and it's a dynamic show. The puppetry is amazing. The sets are gorgeous. But there's so much satire within it. Even, you know, his job is literally just pushing over trees, which was a commentary about the deforestation of the rainforest and other stuff of like, do we really need to do this? Why are we, you know, not recycling? Why are we not doing other things? No, I just go out there and I just shove over trees, man. It's what I do all day. And he's even then like spoofing Home Improvement and stuff like that, because half of his conversations are while he's at work talking to the other people, being all angry about stuff, which is, you know, how Tim Allen was with Home Improvement and others, as he's looking for resolution. Everything had a moment of parody and satire, but they knew they could get away with stuff because people were just going to kind of giggle, because, you know, dad gets home and he gets hit over the head with a frying pan. as you should.
And it's a great callback to stuff like Married with Children and even The Simpsons. Like they knew there were going to be comparisons to The Simpsons, so they just embraced it. So instead of it being Homer abusing his child, it's the child abusing the dad.
Exactly.
But that's my probably 15-20 minute talk on dinosaurs. There are plenty of other YouTube videos out there that will go into more in depth into the production and things like that. But like this is really just us talking about what these things mean to us, especially as adults and going back to these things. Because we mentioned Star Wars, that was like proto Josh discovering nerd culture. I enjoyed Ninja Turtles, Batman, Power Rangers, but like Star Wars literally opened up a whole new world for me in terms of understanding nerd culture and just like what being a nerd could actually mean. And then dinosaurs, that bled perfectly in from Power Rangers, because Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, you have the dinosaurs, even though two of them are not dinosaurs, they're mammals. But like it just all blended together so well for me. Like it's not a 90s thing, but like The Land Before Time was what led me into Power Rangers and my enjoyment of dinosaurs. And then that led into the TV show Dinosaurs. And it's just there's a very clear through line in all that. And it just, I feel like, to just again punctuate and send it home, Dinosaurs has become a little bit of a misunderstood and underappreciated classic. I think it probably survives mostly in like the Jim Henson corner of the internet, where the Jim Henson Production Company and the Creature Shop, where people really appreciate that. That's where I think you'll find most people truly analyzing and talking about the things that made Dinosaurs such a great show, and not just like a memeable show where someone's going to post a picture of Baby Sinclair and be like, yeah, no one really knew about hip hop until this guy. But that's we've talked mostly about two things that really meant a lot to me. Star Wars was a little bit shared, but Alex, what are some nostalgia bait things from the 90s for you?
When I was a young man,
10 years ago,
I would watch TGI Friday. And
did you know? Just because you said TGI Friday, did you know that it meant thank goodness it's funny?
No, it's thank God it's Friday.
They changed it. Like, I think that was the original thing, or they just said it was TGIF, and like everyone just assumed that it meant thank God it's Friday. But there was a time, I can't remember. I know it was like Raven Simone was like hosting TGIF at one point. And she's like, TGIF stands for thank goodness it's funny. And I was like, really? I don't know if it was like a rebranding thing after Disney, but I know for a fact that there was like a promo with Raven Simone where she's like, it means thank goodness it's funny.
Okay. Apparently, at least according to the Wikipedia, that's true. Everyone would assume that, but then they would have the stars say in like the little micro commercials, thank goodness it's funny.
Was Raven Simone in Hanging with Mr. Cooper?
That sounds like it should be true. Yes, she was.
Okay.
Nicole Lee and Hanging with Mr. Cooper.
Okay. So I think that's where it was, where she had done one of those like lead in promos, like Disney Channel used to do with the ears magic wand thing, where I think they had her say, thank goodness it's funny.
Yes. That is so true. Gosh dang it. Now all I can remember is that. Oh, huh. Wikipedia has
Stop being vague and tell us what that is.
I can only picture that. The Raven Simone doing that thing.
Oh, the Disney Channel ears.
Yes, it's burned in my freaking head now. Wikipedia apparently
that's something I haven't seen people talk about a lot yet. Like they say it's a hidden Mickey. But in Disney's Wish, there's a moment where they enchant a quill pen, and it's writing on paper, and it's doing the Disney Channel ears. It's like even the right angle, and everyone's like, "Oh, it's a hidden Mickey." I'm like, "No, it's not. It can't be hidden when they're doing it in the middle of the screen."
Yeah, that's not a hidden Disney Channel. That's an obvious Mickey.
All right, continue. TGIF. Thank goodness it's funny.
you know, you had Step by Step, you had Perfect Strangers on there. God bless Perfect Strangers. You had the Muppets, you had Sabrina. I remember this, I think it was canceled like mid-season, like Teen Angel, about like a kid in high school who died and came back as an angel that it was like there to help his friends.
I vaguely remember that. I mostly remember like the lineup I really remember was Perfect Strangers kicking off. And then I think it led into Step by Step, Family Matters, and then I think Sabrina, the Teenage Witch. And I know Boy Meets World eventually was the like 7:30 or 8 o'clock show. But I know Family Matters was an anchor for that for 10 years.
I can go back and watch it, and I'm still so mad that Disney canceled the sequel series. But it's Boy Meets World. I watched that from day one. I watched it through to its conclusion, which, let me see. So it started when I was like about 8, ended when I was about 15. It ran for 7-ish years. The cast was always a little was older than me, because I think by the time it ended, they were in their sophomore or junior year of college. Corey and Topanga had gotten married and were like living on their own in this really crappy like couple's apartment that they had to be near the school. You had Sean and like his half brother living with, I think it was Angela, the girlfriend, and then the super cute redhead,
Rachel.
Yes, and then Rachel.
Apparently, she has gone off and become an adult film star.
Yeah, she has,
and
she was not invited back.
she's on another '90s. Callback, Christy Carlson Romano has a really good YouTube channel where she just sits down and talks with 90s kid actors or
that's cool,
just kid actors in general. Like she had one with Abigail Breslin that was really good. I think that was the one where she talked about, Christy Carlson Romano talked about how she can go to like Disneyland, Disney World with her kids because the Disney magic in the theme parks is real. Like that, those moments are real. But if she were ever invited to come back to Disney for anything, she would have real reservations about it just because of like what it would mean for her psychologically.
Yeah, I could see that. You know, coming from Even Stevens and all the baggage that comes around all that. Yeah. But for Boy Meets World, for Boy Meets World, it was, when I started to realize that the show's success could dictate being able to pivot to difficult topics, you had, you know, normally it would be like, you know, oh yeah, my friend Sean, he's just not doing that great. You know, it kind of allude to an episode or two of like, oh, maybe he was in a fight or stealing something. But they went deep on it. His dad having alcoholism, his surrogate father getting in a motorcycle accident that they then kind of like brush away, ignoring that. And the struggles of Corey and Topanga trying to make it work as, you know, as adults on their own while staying in college, while being difficulties living together. And the show, it is also where I realized a show could really lean into its flanderization of its characters, because goddamn Will Ferrell, they change
Will Friedle.
Will Friedle. They change Eric from kind of like a dorky, handsome older brother to whatever insanity.
Oh, man. I grabbed some Boy Meets World sound bites, and you're just making me regret I missed Plays with Squirrels.
Yes, Plays with Squirrels.
Eric? No, not Eric, not anymore. It's fine. It's just fine. Okay, well, what is your name now?
My name is Plays with Squirrels.
Oh my god. Plays with Squirrels is like, there were two Boy Meets World bits that stuck with me for forever, and one of them was Plays with Squirrels. I love the name bit where they're like, Eric, plays with? And then Mr. Feeney comes in, he's like, Mr. Matthews, Mr. Squirrels? He's like correcting them.
Hey,
The Secret of Life by Plays with Squirrels.
Okay, everybody, I've got the Secret of Life here, if you want to know.
Fine! Fine!
I can't do it anymore.
Mr. Matthews?
Mr. Squirrels. Eric plays with.
Yeah, they did everything they could to keep the cast, and everything unified. They didn't say, okay, they're going to college, so we're like jettisoning half the cast. No, Mr. Feeney, of course, was there in college with them. They brought that forward. The parents still visited and all that stuff.
Oh yeah, and they had an episode where the mom had like a premature labor as well. Like it was an unconventional pregnancy, an unplanned pregnancy. And like I remember that one, that was a heavy one too. And that one I mostly remember because they named the baby Joshua. And I'm like, oh, that's me. I'm a part of the Matthews family now.
I haven't ever gone back and watched it beginning to end again. I will shuffle and pick an episode.
Rough. I tried giving it a rewatch not that long ago, and that's when they did the jettisoning, because like they have Minkus and a handful of other characters, but like Corey, Topanga, and Sean are like the three that stick. Because I think Mr. Feeney was there, but they also had like a female teacher or a woman principal they did. That was there as well. But like, the school stuff, I think, is the most rough because it's a classroom full of kids. But when they're at home, I think that stuff still works pretty well. But once they get Corey and Sean and Topanga into high school, that's when the show really finds its groove. And that's when it does a lot of really amazing stuff.
Well, they even got rid of his sister, too. They're like, this isn't working.
No,
Morgan.
Morgan was still around. She just she wasn't as prominent.
Well, the reason why I say that is because I vividly remember her disappearing for maybe near an entire season. And then like midway through the next one, she comes downstairs. It's a different actress. And she goes, that was the longest time out I've ever had.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Their Halloween episodes were always solid.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that because I have the best sound clip from one of their Halloween episodes.
Mr. Feeney is dead.
Feeney can't die. How can Feeney die?
He was the first suspect. It's my fault. The second I suspected him, I signed his death warrant.
Well, is any one of us safe?
Yeah, virgins. Virgins never die.
All right. Thanks for saving me.
I'm dead.
I'm dead.
Well, I'll get as sick as you can get without actually dying.
That joke. Okay, the whole virgin thing. I vaguely was aware of that as a kid because I was aware of the status, especially when you have
amazing... the entire episode is a parody of Scream, which had just hit like that previous year. So like I had seen Scream, like most everyone had seen Scream. I think my sisters took me to go see it. And so I was very aware of that rule at that point. I was like, okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm aware of it because of Monster Squad they could probably never do that movie again. Universal would screw it up. They had all their classic monsters, and then you know they get the hot teenage girl they're all lusting after, and they need the virgin to do the ritual. They go through it and nothing works, and she was like, well, it didn't really count. And of course, so they use the young sister to do it. And I mean, and Monster Squad, they're not going to do what they did to her nowadays, where Dracula picks her up by the throat and goes, "You bitch," to a 5-year-old. So back to Boys Meet World, the whole like, I got as close as you can get without, I had no clue. I mean, I was just giggling.
Oh, yeah, that went over my head as much as Ace Ventura's payment at the beginning of Ace Ventura Pet Detective. That sequence, I don't think I actually understood until I was like 22. But I hadn't watched Ace Ventura for like 10 years at that point. Then I found it on DVD, I think, and I was like, oh man, I love this movie, let's see if it holds up. And I just remember seeing that sequence and my jaw dropped. It's like, that's what that was.
Yeah, that took a long time for me to understand what the hell is happening there.
She's so aggressive.
Yeah, still hold on to the door frame. for all the shows that were on TGI Friday, funny, whatever.
TGIF.
It was the one that I never quite emotionally understood everything because it was they were like
sure.
3 to 5 years older than me. But it was just enough that I was starting to understand what they were talking about and what was relevant. And Mr. Feeny has to be one of the best, just wise, understanding, I hope, from, because there's a few episodes where he gets pissed as hell at them, and they deserve it. But he's always kind, and he's always there, and no matter how angry he is for school, he's never angry at them necessarily for making poor life choices. He's just angry at them because there's a disappointment and he knows they just know better.
I think I would have been just out of high school when I learned that William Daniels was also the voice of Kit from Knight Rider.
What?
You didn't know this?
Hell no, I didn't know that. That's
awesome.
Oh my
lord. Yeah, William Daniels, Mr. Feeny, is the voice of Kit from Knight Rider.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think that was around the time YouTube had started becoming a real big thing when I learned this. So I went to see if I could find any kind of clips from Knight Rider. I'm like, no way. Mr. Feeny would not be Kit from Knight Rider. And sure as hell, he is. You listen to that voice, and you're like, Mr. Feeny's trapped in that car.
Holy crap. Oh, man. I'm going to have to go. Yeah, I'm going to have to find. He came back for the TV movies to do Kit again.
It's
bless
a paycheck,
him.
Man.
Hell yeah. He came back for Lego Dimensions.
Really?
To do Kit.
Wow.
Yes. It's credited. Lego Dimensions 2015. Kit voice.
Nice. You get that money, Mr. William Daniels, Mr. Feeny.
Mr. Feeny.
And he's doing Comic-Con circuits too. Like there's,
wow.
I don't think he was at maybe it was C2E2 last year with Will Friedle. But I know he was recently at another big convention. Will Friedle did the Ryan Reynolds Deadpool 3 asking Hugh Jackman to be in the movie bit where like he's just sitting there reading a newspaper on a lawn chair. And he's like, hey, Mr. Feeny, you want to come to New York Comic Con with me? He's like, all right.
Yeah. The movie, the show just resonates because there's not necessarily anyone in the show who is a bad person. Even the bullies, you know, the bullies from the early seasons, they all get their comeuppance of like, well, of, you know, they have home problems too and stuff like that.
Frankie and
Joey
bullies. One of them's the schooner boat guy from Mallrats, and he's also the tolerant football player in Remember the Titans.
Oh man,
he's also the son of wrestler Van Vader. I remember that episode because that was right in the middle of my big WWF Attitude Era phase, where there's an episode where I believe he's Frankie. His dad, they find out that Vader is his dad, but like he's had his face turn where he's no longer a bully and he's like writing poetry but he can't connect with his dad anymore, who is big Van Vader. And so like Sean and Corey know all about wrestling, so they come and coach him and they help him win a match. And it's a fun episode, which again kind of harkens back to episodes that end on a very heartstringy. That's all the TGIF shows. It's like every episode has that heartstring big hug moment.
Oh, yeah.
But that one was just one of those moments where it's like, oh, clearly everyone is watching wrestling right now because of D-Generation X and Shawn Michaels and whatever. We need someone from the WWF in our show. And like Vader was the only one that was available, so they got him.
I still remember when they were doing like their graduation episode when they were transitioning from high school to college, and they're just doing callbacks to all the crap, the plot lines that they dropped. And I absolutely
Minkus showing back up.
Yes. The whole like, Minkus is like the valedictorian. We haven't seen him in years. I was on the other side of the school.
Oh, we don't go over there. I can see it in my head. There, he's pointing. He's like, "Yeah, it's over there." And they, like Sean and Corey are just like, "Oh, we don't go over there."
You see that, Sean? Huh? Do you see how important this week is? Saying goodbye to people we might never see again. Saying goodbye to people who've been around but we sort of lost touch with.
Like who?
Well, I don't know. I guess there's nobody really like that. Hi, Minkus.
Oh, now it's hi, Minkus. For the last 4 years, it's like I haven't even been in the same school with you guys.
Well, you know, we just never saw you around.
I was just in the other part of the school.
What other part of the school?
You know, over there.
Well, we don't go there.
Yeah, you go over there, you may never come back.
Ah, that's crazy. Hey, Mr. Turner, wait up.
It still hits me in the feels in the right way. And I love that it was allowed to grow as it did.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
And it's one of those shows that it can get goofy when it wants to, but it can also be serious when it needs to. Because, like, there's an episode where TGIF did the crossovers all the time. I don't know if they ever got the Family Matters crossover where Urkel showed up, but there was
I don't remember.
I remember there was one Friday where Halloween fell on a Friday that year. So they did a big Sabrina the Teenage Witch crossover event where Salem, like, dimension hopped. So he affected everyone's show. And in the Boy Meets World episode one, he created a World War II drama where Corey has to go off and fight in World War II and they don't know what's going to happen. And it's essentially like, I'm pretty sure Michael Bay or whoever wrote the script for Pearl Harbor watched that episode of Boy Meets World and went, I could do that for 3 hours.
One of the other things I like is that while it was always obvious that Topanga and Eric were going to end up, we're going to end up together. They did an episode or two, like, where they acknowledged that their bodies had changed quite a bit, like, because Topanga was a growing woman, and she was talking about how, like, she felt like fat and like didn't like her body and stuff like that. She doesn't look like the other girls that that the other classmates are dating, and they end up, I think they end up in the swing set where they first like really connected when in like the first or second season. And she's like, I just want to be the beautiful woman that you are. And he's like, you're not going to be like 7 years old.
Yeah.
Weigh 20 pounds. I love you for you, not for what you're becoming. You know, it was that kind of thing. And that was great. And they, when they wanted to have nuance, they could. And when they wanted to have, you know, plays with squirrels stalking the characters for some reason and hiding refrigerators.
But even plays with squirrels, that episode, it's a gut punch because they get so goofy with it. Cause like he has Eric as plays with squirrels. He's like, oh yeah, me manifesto. He's got this giant, like, leather bound Bible of a book. And he's just kind of like, the only thing that is in there is like one sentence, which I can't remember what it is right now. It's basically just like, friends mean everything. Like, family and friends is all you need. I think Mr. Feeney says, like, there's nothing else in here. And he goes, nothing else seemed important at the time. Cause the idea is that, like, it's a branching timeline where Corey and Sean stop being friends or something happens where, like, the group breaks up and they're no longer friends anymore. And Eric goes off and becomes this weird hermit of a man whose name is now plays with squirrels. And he has one lollipop hidden behind his beard.
He eats it
regularly. Yeah. And the only thing he has written of any note is this one sentence of, like, friends and family are the only thing that truly matter in life.
So, Mr. Squirrels, you've written something there, have you?
Oh, yes. I've been by myself for the past 7 years. I've put together a compendium of all my knowledge. Everything I know is in me manifesto. Read it, Jack.
Eric, that thing is like 3,000 pages long.
No, 3,000 blank pages. Only the first one has writing on it.
What does it say?
Well, lose one friend, lose all friends, lose yourself.
So why are all the other pages blank?
Nothing else seemed important.
It's a gut punch because it's what kind of like brings everything back to the main timeline and the group coming back together. And it's a really just beautiful episode, but I'm going to undermine that because there's one particular moment and episode that I just absolutely love. And I will always reference, whether it's in my head or I don't care if people think I'm crazy in the moment. It's an episode where Corian, Sean and Topanga are trying to create an ad for their university, and Corey is too camera shy. So Sean steps in, and there's a moment where Topanga and Sean have to kiss in the script because the idea is they're lovebirds that are going to school together and they're going to get married and still graduate. So Corey becomes jealous because he's like, there's something to that kiss and I'm going to prove it. And so in this soundbite, Corey has kicked Sean out for the night. Sean slept in the quad or the common area on the couch, and Topanga has come to find him, and she's sitting underneath his comforter with him on the couch now.
Well, it's probably no surprise to you that I've had a long, hard night and a lot of time to think. And I know that the two of you are thinking that the crazy little man would dwell and stew and blow all this horribly out of proportion. But I want you to know that I've worked through it. I'm fine. And I am a happy, healthy Corey. And I just want to ask one thing. What's this?
No, Corey, we were just...
Underpants.
I always sleep like this.
Underpants! Here we go. Okay.
I love underpants. I don't sound clip that all you want. Underpants is something that just regularly pops into my head. And the scene goes on further where Topanga like pulls him aside and he's continuing to like antagonize her about how the kiss meant something and he's going to prove it. And if we don't prove it, it's going to haunt us for the rest of our lives. And Topanga goes, why does everything have to haunt us for the rest of our lives? And he goes, underpants. I just, the way Ben Savage, who plays Corey, delivers, when he gets to go goofy, he just loves it and he nails it. Because the goofy stuff is usually safe for like Will Friedle and Matthew Lawrence, a little bit of Sean. But when Corey gets to be goofy, it's just fantastic and it's just wonderful. And I will plug that Will Friedle, Danielle Fisher, and Ryder Strong have a podcast called Pod Meets World where they do the Office Ladies thing where it's an episode by episode breakdown of the show, and they talk about the behind the scenes stuff that only they would know and their experiences on the show. And I will plug that show forever. Like, go listen to it. And also, I think partly because of the success of that podcast, Kyle Higgins is cast Ryder Strong to play Nathan, the first Radiant Black in the Radiant Black audiobook that they're creating. And Will Friedle, who previously played Marshall / Radiant Black 2, is coming back to play Marshall as well. So cool little Boy Meets World tie-ins and comic book tie-ins. But Boy Meets World is another one of those coming of age shows. And as we're talking about it, like, one of the more recent episodes that they've done, I believe, is the episode where Pod Meets World covered the episode where Corey and Sean do a Tootsie. Sean goes undercover to try and like figure out what it's like to be a young woman. And he ends up almost being sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. And it creates a single episode arc where he at least appreciates women for a short period of time and comes to respect them and treat them better than he has. And as I was saying, Corey, Ben Savage gets to play in that moment as well as another woman, but he gets to be the punchline of the whole man dressing up as a woman bit, where like, it's kind of like Blinken in Robin Hood Men in Tights, where he's a little offset. He's like, my pantyhose are bunching. he gets to have the punchlines where Sean gets to have the poignant, heartfelt heartstring moment. So it's one of those things that they play it really well. And again, Ben Savage, younger brother of Fred Savage, he has his own Wonder Years show that I think in many ways actually kind of surpasses the Wonder Years, because they're different shows. Like, Boy Meets World on its surface is a comedy. It's a family sitcom and it's meant to be funny, where I think Wonder Years is meant to be more drama that can be funny in aspects. So they're playing at different ends of the spectrum, but I think that for my money, I think the only thing that really the Wonder Years has given us in the 40 plus years that has been around is Danica McKellar. Like, mm-hmm. she can do no wrong. She's a mathematician. No. She writes children's books. She's on Lifetime and Hallmark movies. Gotta love her. And Fred Savage, mm-hmm. like Fred Savage, again, bless him too, because he has embraced what he has become known for, namely the Princess Bride over the Wonder Years. And he's run with it. Like he had a fun role in a really bad Austin Powers movie, but he's embraced who he is and what he is in Hollywood. And I think so have, Ben Savage, Ryder Strong, Danielle Fisher, Will Friedle, all of them. They I think have adjusted really well to post childhood stardom, and hopefully they were all protected on set. Like that's one thing I really hope that, I think it was Michaels was the production company. I can't remember, but it seems like the kids were well taken care of on those shows. That's one thing that I feel better talking about this sort of stuff right now with this nostalgia bait. Cause like, I would love to talk about all that. I would love to talk about Kenan and Kel, which Kenan and Kel think is something that seems to have been at least taken care of. But I think that's more because they knew that Kenan and Kel were moneymakers for them, where they saw their opportunities with the other people. And I'm not going to get too much deeper into it from there. But we're already past our hour time. So, Alex, do you have anything else from the 90s that you want to nostalgia bait people with?
There's a period of my life for about, I'm going to say 16 years, where I could not get away from Will Friedle.
Yeah.
Because
the president's daughter,
he was,
H.E. double hockey sticks.
Terry McGinnis. Oh no, Terry McGinnis.
Oh yeah. Batman. And he's Batman.
Yeah. He was Batman. I so mad at Warner Brothers and just screwing the pooch with how they destroyed Flashpoint, because God damn it, we got Michael Keaton back twice as Batman, and they tanked one of the movies, and then the other movie was just garbage. We could have had Batman Beyond, and you know what? I don't care who the hell they got for the suit, as long as Will Friedle does the voice, because the best
that damn suit is really hard to translate, though, because it covers, I think it was Batman Arkham City. They did the suit, which it was like overly teched up because it's the Arkham games. Yeah. But there was like a shield in front of the mask, mm-hmm. instead of it being like, oh, the suit covers everything up to my lips and including my lips.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's a translation issue with the Batman Beyond suit that if you did it in live action, it's not going to work well. But there are people who are trying to push for a Spider-Verse style Batman Beyond movie, which conceptually I love the idea of it. In execution, it's going to fail because people are just going to be like, they're doing Spider-Verse with a future Batman. And I think we would love it. We would appreciate it for what it is. But I don't know that anyone who is not familiar with Batman Beyond, the animated series, would be able to get into it. And they would just see it as a Spider-Verse knockoff.
See, one of the things I absolutely love about the Batman Beyond stuff is the Return of the Joker movie. I didn't see that because it didn't air on TV. You know, it was released like to VHS or whatever. But my wife didn't. She's like, this is actually the best probably Batman movie ever. And it's because of the way that first off, it's dark as hell, but it does have the defining moments of why Terry McGinnis is not Bruce Wayne. And to spoiler alert, he's fighting the Joker and he starts quipping, because Terry McGinnis does that. He's a quipper. He's a young kind of like jerky teen, or like late teens or something like that.
Yeah, he's a college kid.
Yeah, and he just likes to run his mouth a bit. And so he's running the mouth at the Joker. And of course, it is our Lord and Savior Luke Skywalker, Mark Hamill, doing the voice. And of course, Batman is being done by a little more gravelly Kevin Conroy, rest in peace. But he's quipping at him, and the Joker's just getting angrier and angrier. It was like, why are you talking? And blah, 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 blah. And finally, and Terry McGinnis finally goes, oh, you're not used to this, are you? And then he starts needling him about the Joker can't tell a good joke. And it just gets Mark Hamill more and more pissed.
Any suggestions, boss?
Joker's vain and likes to talk. He'll try to distract you, but don't listen. Block it out and power on through.
Wait, I like to talk too. Impudent brat. Who do you think you're talking to? Not a comedian, I'll tell you that. Shut your mouth! The real Batman never talked to you much, did he? That's probably why you were so fixated on him.
Don't play psychoanalyst with me, boy!
Oh, I don't need a degree to figure you out. The real reason you kept coming back was you never got a laugh out of the old man.
It's fantastic.
It's beautiful. It's like a 3-4 minute sequence while they're fighting, and this the running of the mouth, and there's a great payoff to it. But I love Will Friedle's voice of just Terry. He just nailed it. He went from going from Eric to that, to the hard pivot. Of Will Friedle is perfect.
Well, that was his first voice actor role too. I've loved Will Friedle since Boy Meets World, but like I've obviously he kind of fell off the face of the earth for a while, but he kind of came back with the rise of podcasting, and he and Christy Carlson Romano had done a podcast called I Hear Voices, which I think ran from like 2019 to 2022. I think they ended it with the death of Kevin Conroy, mm-hmm. which Kevin Conroy is like Will Friedle's idol and life coach in terms of voice acting. Yeah. But because they were on like Kim Possible together, they're like, yeah, let's nostalgia. Plus we're giving voice actors a podium to come up to and speak their mind. And we can share our perspective on the whole thing too. And he was talking about how Andrea Romano had like brought him into audition, and he's like, are you sure? Like, I'm not a voice actor. And she's just like, yeah, we will get through this together. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Conroy was very forthcoming with him. He's like, dude, I was a Shakespearean actor. I had no idea who Batman was when I auditioned for this role. And he just helped him understand even little details of like how to turn a page when you're reading it in the recording booth so you don't make noise. And there's so much good stuff that Will Friedle is openly sharing and willing to share about his experiences with Batman Beyond and just being a voice actor in general, that if you look for it, you can find it. He's done a few other podcasts, or you can just YouTube most of this stuff too. But yeah, Batman Beyond, Return of the Joker, and Mask of the Phantasm, like those are 1A, 1B best Batman movies ever.
Yeah, I'm really glad that they released the uncut version on the Blu-ray, because they took out a few of the much darker, they're really frames that they just edited out, because that movie, it goes pretty hard with why the Joker's gone and why Harley's gone and the trauma that Batman has from dealing with that stuff. And also the trauma that his Robins have from dealing with that stuff, which is really good that they acknowledge all that. But before
if you like Batman Beyond, again, plugging Kyle Higgins and tying into Will Friedle, Kyle Higgins did a Batman Beyond 2.0, which is a direct extension of the Batman Beyond series. It's not anything tied to like the DC Comics universe. It's tied to the animated universe. It's one of the things that I think, unlike his Power Rangers run, I feel like the tone shifts a little too hard, because one of the things Kyle Higgins likes to do is he likes to age the materials so that it's... my internet might be acting funky again. Hopefully it doesn't crap out. One of the things Kyle Higgins likes to do is he likes to age up the material so that when you're reading it, it feels like what you remember it being, not what it actually is. So like when you read Power Rangers number 0, Power Rangers number 1 that he wrote, you're like, yeah, this is Power Rangers. This is how it made me feel on Saturday mornings. But if you go back and watch it, you're like, God, this is campy. Like what are these visual effects that are happening? What is all this? But that's not what I remember. But the way he writes it, it feels like how you remember it. And it's a great talent. And I think he does that really well with all of his nostalgia stuff that he does. But I feel like he does pivot a little too hard, because there's a Terry and Bruce have had a breakup, as often happens. And he's moved. Terry has moved on to Dick Grayson as his Batman mentor. And Dick and Bruce are also on the outs because, spoiler alert for a 10-year-old comic, Bruce and Barbara had an affair, for lack of a better word. Dick and Barbara were not married, but Bruce and Barbara hooked up in a point where Dick and Barbara were having a fight, I think, or like they were broken up, but Dick was like on his way to get back together with her. And that was like the straw that broke the camel's back. And I'm like, you can always, there are other ways to make Dick and Bruce fight, that it doesn't have to be Bruce banging someone that's 20 years younger than him. But that was also around the time that The Killing Joke was coming out, the animated movie. So like maybe that was a little bit of synergy that DC made him throw in. I don't know. But I do think in terms of the actual storytelling and the things that Terry is doing to be Batman, that's all really good stuff. I just think that the drama between Bruce, Terry, and Dick is a little too much soap opera.
So there is one last thing I'd like to mention. Do you remember when the Sci-Fi Channel used to be just called the Sci-Fi Channel?
Yeah. And it was SCI-FI, like the science fiction channel. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember an X-Files knockoff show called First Wave?
I do not.
Okay. I'm not going to spend much time on this because you can't find it anywhere and it pisses me off. Unless they occasionally re-air it, which they have from time to time, and I've caught bits and snippets. So it ran for 3 seasons. It was from, I think, 97 to 2000 or 97 to 90, whatever.
Is this kind of like when Cartoon Network / Adult Swim decides to just air home movies every now and again?
Exactly. So the show is about this guy who's the chosen one who notices something funky is going on with the world. And in order to do so, he has to use Nostradamus's quatrains, because the Earth is being invaded and it's going to be happening in 3 waves. The show is called First Wave. And what's happening is there's this alien species who like needs our bodies as and refer to our bodies as husks, and settles inside of them. So yes, there's a little bit of like Babylon 5 Cylon stuff going out there. And it is the show that one told me what the hell, or no, Battlestar Galactica, not Babylon 5. Sorry. Is a show that taught me Nostradamus is a thing. So then I end up like, you know, being 14 years old, going to the library and picking up Nostradamus's quatrains, which of course is like in the occult section, which is like in the mystery section, which is of course in the like woo-woo insanity section. And I'm reading them like Nostradamus, a commentary, all, you know, the complete collection, the complete expanded collection, all the weird crap. But I anytime the show's on, because it has a mood and it has an energy to it that is unlike any of like the knockoff shows. And it is so stupid, because he invents this computer program that data mines all the quatrains and the prophecies, so we can kind of like predict where they're going to happen, where these like infestations of goo will take over for the new husks. And then he finds out more and more, like apparently the husks are very much like the Borg. They're just relentless, emotionless creatures. Even procreation hurts, but they have to kind of like use our bodies to like make more of them. It is not a great show, but because of that like core memory drop of like watching the X-Files as a kid, which you've heard my love of the X-Files. Everyone's heard my love of the X-Files way too much. But this is another one that I would kind of like also watch in tandem, because I knew it was a knockoff, but at the same time, it was just enough bizarreness and like just tickled that part of my head enough where it's like, this could be true. What are Nostradamus's quatrains telling us? But really, the reason why I bring that up is because I'm ticked off, because I would like to rewatch that show. I would like to give it a shot. It's only 66 episodes, 3 seasons, going canceled, but I can't watch it. Nor can I watch The Secret World of Alex Mack, because for some reason, even though I...
Oh, Secret World of Alex Mack, yes.
Even though I have Paramount Plus, it's not on there. Why isn't it on there? I would like to re...
That is a great question. Why wouldn't it be on there? Because, like, they have The Adventures of Pete and Pete, don't they?
Oh my God, Pete and Pete, no.
I feel like The Adventures of Pete and Pete would be on there, so should...
But yeah, it bothers me that it's not on there. You have my money. You have... You know what you are. You know that I am yours. Just give me The Secret World of Alex Mack. Give me, you know, The Famous Jet Jackson.
Well, that's Disney.
Yes, but Disney also does not have it. Disney doesn't have The Famous Jet Jackson.
Yeah. Yeah, that Jet Jackson, I can kind of understand, because like Disney doesn't want to give away money, and I feel like if you do The Famous Jet Jackson, you should donate portions of the revenue somehow, but that requires them to share streaming data as well. So like,
yeah,
how do you go about doing that? With while being respectful of the deceased actor who played Jet Jackson,
Lee Thomas something, but yeah,
Lee Thompson Young, yep. Lee Thompson Young. So I think there's a little bit of a gray area there, because again, you don't want, as Disney, you don't want to be seeming like you're profiting off the nostalgia for a dead young actor.
But I mean, so many of those late 90s, early 2000s shows just, you know.
Well, if you like this nostalgia bait, maybe we'll come back, because I mean, we only touched on like 4 things from the 90s, and there's plenty of stuff from the 90s we could really dive into. We've got X-Men 97 wrapping up. I think there's 2 weeks left in that. Alex is getting a month long vacation coming up. So I've got to figure out some things to do while he's gone, including remembering how to edit. But yeah, if you like the nostalgia bait stuff, I know I could definitely bring on some guests to help out with that, as well as just go on rants about dinosaurs some more or other things from TGIF. But Alex, remind everyone that by the time you get back, maybe you'll just make it in time for a raffle for a chance to win Midnight Suns on Steam.
Oh, I'll be here. Because you know what? No more of that Friends bullshit. Listen, we have episode 150. It's going to be Smackdowns. And by tossing a suggestion to us, you are entered into a raffle for a copy of Midnight Suns, a Steam code for that. Now, the reason why you want to play Midnight Suns is because by the time our episode comes out and we'll be doing this giveaway, Helldivers 2 will probably be removed from Steam because Sony effed up.
Sony be effing up all the time.
But yes, we need your suggestions. We want them, you know, would they fight to the death?
Baffles me that they have $26 million cash to offer to Paramount. Like, I know they make their money through the electronics, and then they launder it through their movie making industry.
Allegedly.
But dear Lord, how do they have $26 billion in cash?
And it looks like they're going to get it too. Well, that's going to be
It's
going to be an interesting thing if Sony owns Paramount. But anyway,
I saw that brings the like big there used to be 6 big movie production houses before Disney bought Fox. Mm-hmm. And now if Sony buys Paramount, that brings us down to 4. Yep. And we are just that much closer to, by and large, from WALL-E.
Oh, but man, those hover pods look comfortable though.
Yeah.
I mean, all your entertainment and food at your fingertips and just floating around in a hover pod.
Breakfast in a cup.
Exactly. And you know,
isn't that just Starbucks?
Oh, Starbucks wishes they could.
I'm sure they do.
But yes, give us your suggestions. All right. We entered for a raffle. Tweet us.
Well, Alex, thank you for your time and have a wonderful vacation without me. I will make sure your litter box is plenty clean by the time you get back. For those of you listening, please, if you enjoyed this episode of Nostalgia Bait, maybe we make it a regular thing and we take it into decades. You can send us emails at tsmackpod@gmail.com with your suggestions. You can leave us reviews where you let us know if you would rather listen to this podcast or watch Madam Web. You can do that on your favorite podcatcher. You can follow us on all the social media platforms at Talking Smack Pod on Blue Sky, Instagram, Threads, Hive Social, Post News, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, and Lonnie's website. Don't forget to join our Discord. Join in on the conversation. The link is in the episode description. Thank you to Leo Allen for our musical themes that you're hearing right now. Alex, who's doing the remix?
I am. This is My Touch, and it is good. You can barely hear it, but there's just a little twinge where we dropped a G right there.
That's where the beat drops. Mm-hmm. Thank you to Beppo for original avatars, Retro Ale Studios for our Ricky avatar. Again, please don't forget to like, subscribe, rate, review on your podcatcher of choice or on YouTube. And most importantly, thank you, dear listener, for taking the time out of your day to listen to this. And take care. And watch Star Trek.
You know, Star Trek, TNG, and DS9 were in the 90s. Let's talk a little bit about them. So,
who loves T-Smack?
I love T-Smack. Is it true? Mm-hmm. I do. Ooh.